Welcome to Without Fear, Life, Death, and Everything in Between, a podcast for anyone ready to embrace life's ultimate truth. It ends. I'm Death Doula Alexis Hughes, here to break down barriers around mortality through heartfelt conversations, personal insights, and practical tools for facing the end with courage and intention. Whether you're curious about death, navigating grief, or seeking ways to live more fully, this is your safe space to explore life's most transformative topics. Together, we'll turn fear into understanding and silence into connection.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Thank you for making time for this, for choosing to sit with this conversation, even if it's uncomfortable, for being someone willing to look inward and to look closely at the things most of the world avoids. This podcast is for those who are brave enough to ask, what does it mean to die well? What does it mean to die and to live well, knowing that death is always walking beside us? This is Without Fear, Life, Death, and Everything in Between. I'm Alexis Hughes, death doula, sin eater, and your host. We've got a guest co-host with us today. This is Brinley, my little old man. We'll talk about him in a bit. But first, today's episode is called It's Never About the Dishes. So it's something that happens more often than you might think. This is actually one of my favorite stories to tell. And if you've ever heard me speak or you know me in person, you've probably heard it more than once. It just really encapsulates the point of all of this. And I'm sure you've seen this play out in your own life or with someone that you know. See, people reach out to me for all sorts of reasons. Some of them are practical, some are emotional, and some are urgent. But over the years, I've come to see a pattern. The thing they say they need help with is rarely, if ever, the thing they actually need help with. They ask me about paperwork. They ask about logistics. They ask about burial options or home care agencies or legal referrals. We go through the very sterile checklist, the very stoic procedures. And while those are valid needs, of course, right? We have to get things done. Almost always, something deeper is going on. What's really at stake is rarely what is being openly said. And today I want to tell you a story about one such moment. It started, as many of them do, in the middle of the night. I usually check my email in the early mornings. I get up, it's one of the first things that I do. It's part of the rhythm of how I work because death doesn't have office hours. And part of it's because I've learned that when someone reaches out late, that they're not just looking for information. They're looking for peace. It was around 3:05, 3:10 a.m. when her message came through. And the ding woke me up because I always keep my alerts on my phone active because, well, somebody might be dying. I always sleep with my phone under my pillow. And she introduced herself very plainly. No punctuation, no signature, just a request. Can you help me review my will? Responded as I always do, kindly, clearly, with boundaries, considering it's the middle of the night. And I let her know I'm not a lawyer. I don't give legal advice, but I would be happy to take a look and let her know if anything seemed amiss, out of the ordinary, or if she might want to speak to one of the legal professionals that I often collaborate with. I asked her about her availability and she sent it over to me. And so we made an appointment for later in that day, once we both had more sleep. And I went across town. She's a lovely woman, very pleasant, but you could just tell that there was something else, just a cloud just hung over her. And she welcomed me into the house, offered me some water, tea, soda, and I chose soda and sat down with her document in the hand. So I read through it slowly, line by line. It's clean, uncomplicated. Basic assets, basic instructions, no ambiguities, no red flags, nothing. I read it again. I was waiting for like the Fay Law loophole or something like that that I had like missed in it. And I couldn't find anything. It was just a simple, clear plan for what she wanted after her death. But that didn't really sit right. She looked kind of uncomfortable. She wouldn't really like look at me while we were talking. And but it wasn't with the document itself. It was with the timing of it all. Why had she written to me about this in the early hours of the morning if everything was already in order, right? Like, this was a dang near perfect document. What was the deal? What had really kept her up at night? What make her Google me and find me in the middle of the night to come look at it and not like a lawyer? So I've just, you know, put the paper back together, handed it to her, and I probed gently. I said, your will is clear. It's straightforward. It seems well thought out. So I'm wondering, is this really what's keeping you up in the middle of the night? Or is there something else on your heart with this? There was a pause. A long one. And she kind of wrung her hands a little bit, and then came her answer. She said, my children are fighting. She gave me a little bit of details, and it wasn't about her care. It wasn't about the will itself. Not about the hospital bills or visitation or power of attorney. They were fighting about the heirloom china. She gestured to a beautifully carved wooden cabinet behind me in the dining room in the next room. The glass doors were pristine and shining with the sunshine coming in through the windows. It was a set of finely made porcelain dishes passed down from her grandmother, stored in the hutch in the dining room. That's what they're arguing about. Three daughters, one son, and the daughters were at odds about plates. She was losing sleep, literally, because her daughters were in conflict over teacups. And as she said it out loud, I could sense like the shame that she felt over it. She thought it sounded silly, small, embarrassing. Like, I've called a professional in here to tell you that my kids are fighting over dishes. But I didn't laugh. It's not funny. Because I've seen it too many times before. And I knew immediately that this was not about the dishes. I asked if I could come by her house later that week, and she agreed. So when I arrived back at the house, the atmosphere was already tense. Her adult children were there, hovering in corners, avoiding eye contact, speaking in very clipped, short sentences. You know, the kind. Biting, almost. Now, her hospice nurse had just left. She was in her bedroom, lying quietly, too weak to come out, but fully alert. She could hear everything. And she was fully aware that her children were at war. I could see it in her eyes, and I could feel it just in her energy. And she wasn't worried about dying. We all knew that was coming. She was worried about leaving her children behind in pieces. So I gathered them in the dining room, told them to sit down. They sat around the old wooden table, the one they'd grown up eating dinner on. The china cabinet loomed behind them silently. I didn't waste any time. I cut right in. And normally there's some introduction and you get to know the family and things like this, but this was kind of my first introduction to them, and I kind of already had it. And I just said, your mother's dying of cancer in the next room. She can hear you arguing. She can hear the stuff you're saying. She can hear every single word. She sent me an email at 3 a.m. in the morning because you are breaking her heart. You're in here screaming over stuff, and it is killing her faster. Enough to keep her up in the middle of the night to send a stranger that she Googled an email. I pulled up my phone and pulled up a copy of the email, and I showed it to her. Pointed to the time signature. Nothing. They just sat there with their arms crossed, kind of looking uncomfortable and low-key looking at each other around the table. So I said again, what is the problem? What is really the problem here? One of the quieter sisters, the middle child, cracked first. She said, it's always been like this, she said. Ever since we were kids, she always got what she wanted. And I remember one time in middle school, I begged mom for new shoes for basketball tryouts, but I couldn't get them because she needed new ballet shoes. And she pointed at the older sister, kind of lean across the table, said, she always got everything. And now she's trying to take the damn dishes too. Gloves off. You've seen girls take off earrings and stuff like that before they're about to get into fisticuffs. They blew up. The whole room erupted. Raised voices, years of resentment, fingers in the face, moments dredged up from childhood, the uneven Christmas gifts, who got a new car, who got more praise. This wasn't about the dishes. This was about grief and jealousy, about wounds that never got named and thusly never healed. So I sat there quietly, listened. I sent them all to separate places in the house to take a 10 count and calm down. And I made a decision very quickly. Stepped outside on the front porch and I called a colleague, a licensed family counselor who I've had the pleasure of working with many times. She did me a solid and had an opening in her schedule, and I was able to get her to come over the next day. And so over the course of several days, they sat at that same table, and with the counselor guiding them, they unpacked the grief and bitterness and all that they've been carrying for decades. Cried, yelled, started to remember, started to laugh, started to tell stories about when they were kids. And then they apologized. And in that entire process, something shifted. They stopped talking about the dishes altogether. And by about the second or third day, no one wanted the dishes anymore. Instead, they wrapped them carefully in tissue paper and boxed them up. They gave them together to their brother, the fourth child, who was preparing for his wedding later that year. A family gift, a shared offering, a sign of unity and not division. The woman, their mother, was still alive when they gave him the box. She smiled as he held it, and she closed her eyes. And she rested. Not because it was perfect. Not because everything was neatly resolved and tied up with a bow like a Hallmark movie. But because her children had finally stopped fighting. Because the dishes were never the issue. The dishes were never the point. Because they had finally seen, really seen, what was underneath the dishes. And when families argue near the end of life, over heirlooms, medical choices, funeral details, it's rarely about the specific decisions or items, right? It's about what those things represent. Control, fairness, recognition, grief, legacy, love withheld, love wanted. The dishes, the will, the medical directive. They're containers. They hold decades of emotional sediment, resentment, regret, longing, fear. It's easier to point at the distribution of the stuff in a family home and say, than to say, I never felt seen by mom. Or it's easier to fight over a casket color than to admit, I'm scared to lose the one person who kept us connected. A study published in Omega, the Journal of Death and Dying, found that nearly 80% of families experience some level of conflict during the end-of-life process, often intermittently or consistently between various members of the family. These aren't just disagreements over logistics. They're manifestations of unresolved relational wounds, heightened by the stress of watching someone they love decline. End-of-life conflict isn't just circumstantial. It's neurologically and psychologically predictable. In a 2022 report from the Family Caregiver Alliance, 60% of family caregivers report strained relationships with siblings during shared care of a parent. The same study found the lack of communication before a crisis is a primary trigger of breakdown. Add to this the heightened cortisol levels that come with anticipatory grief. And the result is a family under pressure with old survival strategies coming back into play. The oldest child tries to control everything. The middle child retreats or lashes out. The one who moved away feels like they don't belong or feels resentful that they've been expected to drop their life in return. Each person isn't just responding to the present. They're reacting from the script that they've been reading from childhood. And Like my mom used to say, if you don't pass the class, you're going to continue to have to retake it. So until these behavioral systems and patterns are broken within a family dynamic, that's how you're always going to act because you don't know anything else. Everyone has the power, of course, to look inside and see that. But you are then put in an impossible situation of also having an external of watching someone that you care about die. It's not the time for inner reflection. It's not the time to discover I need therapy and I'm going to fix this before I lose dad. That's an impossible ask. So that's why a doula like myself or any of my other end-of-life colleagues can bring someone in to handle it while we continue our work with what's going on with the family. We're going to take a really quick break and hear some great information during that break from the Transformation Talk Radio Network. And we will be right back to continue talking about stuff nobody wants to talk about. See you in a few.
Do you want to become a host? Start your own podcast to inspire, persuade, and influence others on what you're passionate about? At the Transformation Network, we can help make your talk radio dreams happen. Let's take your hopes, dreams, and passions and put them on air today. Email us at host@transformationtalkradio.com to learn more about becoming a host of your very own show.
Welcome back. Are you uncomfortable? Do you know someone that you need to talk to about some stuff? Good. This is done. Pick up the phone. My co-host has left. I did something a little different today because as we are talking about death, I'm a cat mom and we've had to recently put two of our older cats to sleep and he is the third brother. He's getting a little older. So I fully embraced today. He was in here moving around and wanted to perpetually be in the way. And I was like, oh, it'll be great to have Brimley on the show today. So, you know, everybody can see him and I can share the magic of mischief that is he with everyone else. And of course, in true cat nature, I'm like, hey, buddy, you want to be on the show today? And he leaves. So maybe perhaps another day. But back to the story at hand. So what do you do in these moments, right? What if you don't have a death doula handy or you want to handle it yourself? Well, what helps in these moments isn't another form, another meeting, another plan. Like there's nothing structured about this. Every situation is different. So there is no formula. But what helps is preserving the space to speak that deeper truth. When I asked the daughters from the China story, what is your deal? What is going on here? One, no one had ever been that direct with them. It was just kind of a, well, they're just like that situation. But what I really offered them was permission. Permission to stop pretending that everything was fine, to stop pretending that it was about the dishes. Permission to grieve what was broken between them. Permission to say out loud that what had only been said in silence or sideways remarks or stabs or passive aggressive or commentary or being late to a birthday party on purpose or whatever. Sometimes it just takes a neutral presence, right? Someone who can ask the question that the family either doesn't know how to ask or is afraid to. Because when I ask, what is the real problem here? You don't know what you're going to get. That can open a Pandora's box that once open could do a lot. So you really have to be prepared for that. And sometimes it takes a therapist, a mediator, or yes, a death doula. But sometimes it just takes someone being brave enough to say, I don't think this is about the dishes. So if you're facing any end of life planning with a loved one or trying to make peace with siblings, partners, parents, children, pause. Take a tenor. Sit with your feelings. And ask yourself, what is this really about? What are we trying to protect? what hurt hasn't been healed. And these are things that don't even have to happen at death, right? We still want to live good lives. So the things we do at death, pick them up and scoot them forward. If you've got some junk going on in your family and you're walking into Thanksgiving and your guts are knotted up because you know something's going to hit the fan, what is this really about? What are we trying to protect? Or who or whose feelings? What are you trying to protect? The peace? What hurt hasn't been healed? And another one that I always like to ask is, what is the closure worth? If you get closure, but it involves absolutely uprooting everything in your family and just an unhinged level of drama, is it worth it? How much peace are you willing to disrupt to gain your peace? And as your chaotic, unhinged bestie, I would tell you that your peace should, there's no cost too high. For overall peace and doing less harm, you got to rip the Band-Aid off. Because the china, the ring, the house, the will, they're only symbols. And what matters is what's really underneath. If you're the one nearing the end, know this. The things that your loved one will carry after you die won't be material. It's not stuff. They'll carry how they were treated. They'll carry what was said and what wasn't. They'll carry the unresolved or the reconciled. We can choose now, right now, to name the truth and begin healing before the last breath, before the dishes get broken, before it's too late. And I say before the dishes get broken because those three girls, in the heat of it, they were this close to pulling each other's hair. I could have walked over and pushed that whole china cabinet over and broken every one of them dishes, and they wouldn't have given a single flip. It was never about the plates. They didn't care. It was about the shoes and who got a new prom dress and who got stuff and who did mom tell they loved the most and things like that. It's never about the dishes. And end-of-life care is not solely about managing the physical symptoms, right? We come in, we try to provide holistic care. We work with the hospice team for medical mitigation. It's not just about the medications, the pain scores, or medical directives. While those are critical, they're only a part of the whole picture. Real end-of-life care must also address the emotional and psychological terrain, not only for the person who is dying, but for everyone orbiting that experience. Something that I constantly tell folks when I'm doing life coaching and things like that is you do not exist in a vacuum. You might not think that it does, but we all know that a hurricane across the world can be caused by the beat of a butterfly's wings in your backyard. You do not exist in a bubble. You do not exist in a vacuum. Everyone is a part of the death experience, even if you're not the one dying. Even if you're tangentially, tertiary involved, it is still impacting you somehow. Even if it's not your direct person, right? It is an in-law. It is a coworker's wife or something like that. You are still in the wake of that death experience that is happening, even if it's in your periphery. Because when someone is nearing the end, and what rises most vividly is not only pain, but fear. Not only fatigue, but longing. Questions begin to surface quietly, urgently, sometimes wordlessly and existentially. Did my life matter? Did I leave peace behind me? Who will carry on my memory? Did I love well? Was I loved? Was I a good person? These are all spiritual questions, emotional questions, human questions. And if we're not prepared to meet them with presence, with care and patience, we miss one of the greatest invitations of the dying process, the chance to witness truth and offer peace. According to the National Coalition for Hospice and Palliative Care, the majority of patients receiving hospice express a growing need for spiritual or existential support as death nears. This includes assistance navigating meaning, forgiveness, unresolved relationships, and fear of the unknown. You run out of checklists, you run out of forms, and then you are left with the higher order problems and questions. And yet many families are unprepared or overwhelmed, or there's too much going on to hold space for that work. 2020 study of the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management found that 59% of patients nearing the end of life reported psychological or emotional distress, with anxiety, sadness, and fear among the most common. And nearly 50% of family caregivers in that same study said they felt emotionally unequipped to support their loved ones during these final conversations. This isn't because the families don't care. It's because they haven't been taught how to be emotionally present in death. It's because they don't have the tools to be emotionally present at all. And this is very specifically to me an American culture problem. Our culture prepares us to fight death, to delay it, to fear it, to not admit that it's even going to happen, but not to sit beside it, not to speak honestly with it, not to walk someone to its edge with steady hands and open hearts. But we can learn. And when we do, the difference is really, really profound. So understanding that conflicts during end-of-life situations often stem from deeper emotional issues allows us to approach these moments with empathy and openness by fostering honest communication, seeking professional support when needed, and focusing on the emotional well-being of everyone involved. We can navigate these challenging times with grace and compassion. So see, we've come full circle all the way around. From a mother lying in bed, listening to her daughters argue and scream in the next room, to decades-old wounds breaking open over a set of plates, to the hard healing work that follows when the real conversations begin. And if there's one thing I've learned over the years, it's this. Conflicts at the end of life are rarely about what we think they are. They aren't about the will. They aren't about the medical decisions. They are not about the china. They're about what's unspoken, what's unresolved. They're about childhood hurts, buried grief, unacknowledged jealousy, favoritism, the praise we didn't get, the apology we never heard, the accountability that was never taken. And when we finally name that, right there, when we stop pretending the problem is logistics, something changes. Understanding this truth allows us to meet these moments not only with defensiveness, not with defensiveness, but with clarity, not with avoidance, but with courage. And I'm just going to tell you some unsolicited advice. Go to therapy. I don't care if you think I don't need therapy. Everyone needs therapy. Go to therapy. Even if therapy is just talking really emotionally vulnerably with someone that you can trust, flex those emotional muscles and practice it. Your emotional vulnerability, your emotional intelligence is a muscle, just like in the gym. So thank you for joining me on this journey. If this conversation resonated with you, I invite you to explore more resources and support at withoutfeardoula.com. Together, let's continue to face life's most profound moments with courage, understanding, and without fear. Until next time, take care.
I'm Death Doula Alexis Hughes, and you've been listening to Without Fear, Life, Death, and Everything in Between. Join me every third Monday, 3:30 p.m. Pacific, 6:30 p.m. Eastern Standard, on Transformation Talk Radio for honest conversations about life's final chapter. Together, we'll break down barriers around mortality and empower you with practical tools to start meaningful conversations with your loved ones about end-of-life wishes. To learn more about end-of-life support and my work as a death doula, visit withoutfeardoula.com. Thanks for listening.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.